I'll give you a little bit of the thesis of what I've been working on the last few years, like how we got to where we are now. And then I'll ask you this next question back in the public episode. I promise this will all come together. But I was doing this survey research of young people at the time, ages 12 to 17, how they were getting politicized online. So studying, memes, video content, all of these different communities on the internet, and then watch them kind of distill into, in some cases, real-world political organizations. People get, politicized in a message board and then go out and canvass. And what are the conversion rates? How does all this stuff work? At the time, there's an enormous surge of interest in far-right ideas. That's what I was trying to combat, right? I was like, okay, if this is possible to recruit all these people, then it must be possible for the left, right? Structurally, diagrammatically, this is a media theory problem. You can plug in different variables and then you can move people in one direction. You could move them in another. The problem that follows that is you then have to survey the entirety of the left and find a place that you could actually send people that won't result in relapses when they encounter other information. Because if you try to send them to these really brittle echo chambers, they encounter another idea and then all of a sudden it's shattered and it's just a very unstable place to put people, right? We're seeing that now with like a lot of the kind of Democrat narratives where, women and people of color are going for the Republicans. How is this possible if the Democrats represent their interests? Like all of this kind of stuff. So to see that your audience is reacting so harshly to you advocating effectively for a policy that they purport to want because you're doing it, I don't know, on a different channel or something. I think part of the problem right now is that what constitutes the left has drifted so far from even what the program is, the, intellectual history, the philosophical grounding, like, I mean, basically any connection to like what this movement is, that the people who are a part of it are just plainly unaware of that stuff. And I'm not saying everybody's got to go back and read three volumes of Capital or whatever, but like being able to advocate for certain things. You were describing before, how incredibly ineffective this system is. From the position of being a socialist in 2025, we are, I think, unbeknownst to ourselves, sometimes making arguments that are actually coming from just common sense liberalism of like the Keynesian variety, right? That's my audience is going to fucking, people are going to hate hearing this, but it's like, okay, you want to, this is, if you really want to get to the truth, like you have to go through these like very unpleasant things. I have a friend who I speak with sometimes. He has lovely opinions on the state of Israel and all sorts of cultural politics I deeply disagree with. He also happens to be a tremendously knowledgeable economist whose job is to lobby Washington in the UK to bring back manufacturing. So if both of us have come to some similar conclusions, I think that that's an indication there's some truth in here. And his thesis, which has been tremendously unpopular until the last few years, basically 8, 9 years ago, was that during the boom of the American, like, golden era of liberalism, the profit margins were so high. America is the world hegemon. Like the other advanced countries are bombed to smithereens. They can't compete. That the construction of what we would call the innovation ecosystem, basically, when the state puts in this money for R&D, we just give that to the private sector. Like no other fucking country in the world would do that. Like they own a chunk of it and then the profits generated from that go back to the state. They're not trying to do this like endless whack-a-mole game of collecting taxes back because they're just getting it on the front end. But basically, because we were so rich in the US, we just designed this really sloppy system and it didn't matter. It didn't matter until Southeast Asia rose, until China rose, until there were actual like examples of economic growth outside of that post-war period. And so now, like a lot of the things that are being kind of advocated for by socialists, but also these kind of like populist, right-wing, like Republican types. Marianna Mazzucato is, I'm sure you're familiar with her work, the economist who she wrote The Entrepreneurial State. And she is not a socialist. She talks about the labor theory of value, which was common amongst liberals basically up until 1971. But she's just making these very coherent arguments. And if you hear her explain how the system works, you're like, well, I had to go all the way to the socialist left to understand how liberals thought like 10 years before I was born.
Yeah.
Like it's really wild how untethered and unrooted we are from like the policies that we're trying to enact. But that's okay. So that's my whole rant that I will conclude for this private version of the podcast where I get to like say what I actually think.
Yeah.
But on this topic of a disjunct between the program we're trying to enact and the narratives that further it in the media, social media, news, whatever, what is the role of media in political organization? Is this education, propaganda, recruitment? How do you envision that problem?
I think that there's probably a place for everything you listed, and it really depends on what the media figure wants to do. The problem is when you're wanting to be more informative and there's this pressure to be a propagandist.
Anna Kasparian, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
In that environment you grew up in, was there a catalytic event that politicized you? How did you first get interested in this stuff?
I was first politicized in 2002, 2003. I was in high school, and this was right before the preemptive war in Iraq happened. I just knew that that war was a really bad idea. After 9/11, I started getting far more engaged with political news. And so I was reading the New York Times, and I just remember thinking to myself before the invasion happened, Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11. I felt that the Bush administration was intentionally confusing people who aren't necessarily super engaged in politics. And so he was manufacturing consent for that war with this trick of making Americans think that Iraq and Saddam Hussein had something to do with 9/11. Obviously, they didn't. And I just remember being really angry about that and furious that we were about to go to war with a country that hadn't attacked us. That's when I became politicized. So my politics actually began with this anti-war mission. Mm-hmm. And then it grew from there. So after college, I start working at the Young Turks. My first job, actually, out of college was for a CBS radio affiliate, local. KNX 1070 was the station I was working at. And it was uninspiring. There was really no critical thinking going on. It might be different today. I feel bad saying that because I don't want anyone who actually is a critical thinker working there now to think, you know, they fall under that category. But at that time, you know, in 2007, you'd have TV writers or news writers come in. They'd grab some sheets from The Wire, AP or Reuters. Mm-hmm. They would just rewrite whatever the news was in a scripted form. Anchor would come in 15 minutes before broadcast and just regurgitate, just read what someone else wrote for them. Yeah, they sounded good, but do they have any relationship to what they're saying? Is there anything going on here? Is there like a deep connection to what these news anchors are saying? Do they believe in anything? So I was uninspired by it. One of my colleagues there told me of a temporary job opening, 2 weeks, at this place called the Young Turks. I immediately got turned off by the name. I'm like, what the hell is the Young Turks? I'm Armenian. Is this like a Turkish place? Like, what's going on? No. It means rebels, rebelling against, you know, societal expectations. Once I understood what the name meant, I was like, it's just 2 weeks. Why not? I need extra money. I was planning on a trip to Europe, my very first foreign trip. And I fell in love with the place because Cenk Uygur walked in, sat down. I mean, the guy's disheveled. He walked in late. Like, you know what I mean? Total disaster. I'm like, what am I doing here? This place is not for me. But the first 5 minutes of his broadcast was chiding the Bush administration, telling the truth about the war in Iraq, you know, talking about the violations of American civil liberties under the Patriot Act. And I was like, yes, this is where I want to be. But it was also scary because it was opinion. And when I was in journalism school, that was a big no-no. You have to pay your dues before you can do op-eds and opinion content.
Right.
So I thought that I was taking a huge risk by even being there, but I felt energized by that environment, and I wanted to stay. So when the 2 weeks were over, I asked Cenk, can I just stay here? I'll do anything. I know you don't have any job openings, but I'll do anything. And he needed someone to do marketing. I, first of all, hate marketing, have no expertise in it, no interest in it, but I accepted that job offer because I just wanted to be in the room. And I got lucky because the two other hosts at the time started to look at other job opportunities and were looking for an exit. And suddenly Cenk needs an on-air person. And before I know it, I'm doing like entertainment content for the Young Turks. But that was kind of like my step in the door. And then I little by little started introducing and pitching like political content for my hour of the show. And that got a little bit of pushback from Cenk because he's like, I do the political content in the first hour, you do the entertainment. And honestly, what I did was find a middle ground. I started covering like social commentary stuff, whereas he would do the hard politics in the first hour. And then little by little, I kept encroaching. And now I'm the EP and I I basically control the whole main show.
You're going to impose some radical economic agenda that, just checking my notes here, actually existed a generation ago. They're doing this redistribution. You're going to tax people? What, are you crazy?
Yeah. But here's the thing. Taxes for taxes' sake also doesn't make sense. I live in California. I live in Los Angeles, highest taxed state with a very high tax city. And we're currently facing a $12 billion deficit in California and a $1 billion deficit in LA. Unlike the federal government, state and local government has to balance the budget. They don't have the option of running up a massive debt. And so there's been a lot of waste and misuse of taxpayer resources in California. And I don't want anyone to be under the impression that I co-sign onto any of that. I think that taxes make sense when you are funding a social safety net that's well-run and actually does what it's supposed to do in catching people when they fall. At the same time, though, what makes me different from a lot of what I hear on the right is this demonization of individuals who need to rely on Medicaid, Medicare, food stamps. I don't think people are lazy. I think the vast majority of people, including those who have to rely on the social safety net, are hardworking people who have been either dealt a blow through a job loss or something like that, or an emergency in the family, someone got sick. Or there's just no upward mobility in this country anymore. You know, sure, you might be able to point to some anecdotes and some examples, but most people, most workers are not going to be able to do what working class people were able to do in the 1950s. They're not going to be able to buy a house. They're probably going to have to finance a car with an adjustable rate mortgage. They might get it repoed in the in the future. They're going to go bankrupt because of a medical emergency. I mean, it's just really difficult for people to survive out there and to build wealth and to feel financially stable. I think the difference is the mindset, because I think that on the right, there's this idea that there's a lot of people taking advantage of the system. Sure, some of those folks exist. They're called corporations. But for the most part, working class people want to have a purpose in life. They're not lazy bums. They're not getting paid to stay home and sit on the couch. It's hard out there. And I would just ask for the Republican voters in places like the Rust Belt to think about what happened to workers in the Rust Belt and take that experience and just kind of apply it to the entirety of the country, because I think it's happening throughout the country right now. People don't have great job opportunities. There's been this issue of elite overproduction, right? I don't think that four-year institutions are right for everyone. This like looking down your nose at people who decided to pursue the trades instead is really gross. But turns out those are the folks that have like a lot of great job opportunities now, whereas those who went to four-year universities, you know, got a master's degree or PhD, they're having a hard time finding work. And it's funny because those tend to be the individuals who preach against the working class the most. So I think on both sides, I want, and it's really hard to do this, I need to like work on my communication. I really want voters from across the political spectrum to stop dehumanizing each other and come from a place of empathy when they're thinking about the other side. Think about areas of agreement where they can work together. It might start off with like issues-based coalitions, right? Right now I see a potential coalition of right-wingers and left-wingers when it comes to, you know, not going to war with Iran.
Right.
I think Tucker Carlson is genuinely a theocrat. I do. I've been listening to his podcast. I'm doing some research on him. And I think he'd want to live in a theocracy. Like, that guy is obsessed with religion. However, one thing that he's also obsessed with is not going to war with Iran. And homeboy's got the president's ear. So if there's a way to work, even with Tucker Carlson, to avoid a disastrous war, I'm willing to do it. And so that's kind of the project that I'm engaging in with the work I'm doing at TYT. It has not been successful so far because people seem to be repulsed by it. But the question is, what's more important to you, your political identity and being pure, or finding ways to work with like-minded people on specific issues to get what you want? What I really want is to avoid a war with Iran. What I really want is, you know, a system in which workers have a seat at the table. And you're not going to be able to make any of that stuff happen unless you honestly compromise on some social issues and just hyper-focus on that one goal, that one issue, whether it's, you know, the PRO Act, whether it's avoiding war with Iran. You're going to have to work alongside people that you have some disagreements with.
I'm going to try out a bit here, so bear with me about this, and definitely not put this in the public episode. But so this framing of personal failure, if you fall on the social safety net of the state, I think that's something that developed basically within like onset of neoliberalism, like 1971 up until now. There's a transformation. We're entering this age of multipolarity, right? There's superpower competition between the US and China. And American growth rates have been able to be artificially suppressed because profit taking on behalf of enormous corporations is just, it's more lucrative for them to just siphon a disproportionate amount of money out of the economy. China right now is larger, 5.5% annual growth rate, is larger than the United States was at the boom of liberalism in like the, you know, 60s. So I've heard this phrase to me, and this is from people who are Ordo-Trotskyites, so this is a rather deep cut. But his theory was that if we look at the social safety net through the lens of austerity, Americans spend 2 to 1 versus any other advanced country on our healthcare. That is an enormous amount of fat in the economy that goes to the people who own our pharmaceuticals, our healthcare industry, and so on. What that means through a lens of superpower competition is that half of that expenditure could be going to other sectors of the economy and increasing productivity and growth and so on. So if you, you know, and forgive the framing, but you look at these states as giant productive corporations, there is a lens at which the Republicans will stop arguing about the personal failures of individuals for falling on that social safety net and begin to call for austerity. I think this is what Steve Bannon is kind of moving towards. They're going to call for single-payer healthcare as an austerity measure so that we can more effectively compete with China, because we are lagging behind in this 2-to-1 rate of American productivity and consumption just basically being sucked down a black hole for a few people who own the whole industry. So I start to wonder what that means. I'm going on a whole tangent here. This is definitely behind the paywall, but this is
the fascinating
kind of long-term strategy that I think about. What if, as people who are on this economic left, we don't make the argument about, well, it's not a moral failing of these people. It's not their fault that they had hard luck or whatever. what if we just start to make the austerity argument? Mm. We make the neoliberal argument that it's just more cost effective and it's more competitive and it's larger economic growth. Like, I've tried this out on conservative people, like the free market types too.
It works.
And they're just like, they like short circuit. Uh-huh. They don't know what to do about it. And so I'm just kind of thinking of like diffusing some of those ideas in advance. And we could kind of shift the terrain on which these conversations are even had. And the intended effect is that the people who are our political opponents end up arguing for the policies that we want.
Yeah.
I think that's, if we could pull off that kind of hairpin turn, I think that would be a tremendous discursive victory.
Okay, that is actually pretty genius. And it kind of goes to an issue that I've been having with like the lack of strategic thinking on the left, right? So I'll give you an example of something I did that was really, really interesting. So Megyn Kelly, who's very conservative, of course, she keeps inviting me to come on her show, knowing that I'm on the left, especially on like these economic issues. And I really respect the fact that she's willing to do that, that she can sit down and have a conversation with someone who comes from a different political ideology. And in one of the episodes, I decided I need to make my arguments in a way that would be appealing to her, right? And one of the arguments I wanted to talk about was pharmaceutical drug companies, the fact that Medicare isn't even allowed to negotiate drug prices, which is insane. And so all Americans, whether you're a Democrat or Republican, should be furious about that, because that's our taxpayer money and we're getting price gouged a lot of times by the same pharmaceutical companies that we pay the research and development for.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
We should own those companies, to be honest with you, but we don't.
Yeah.
So to be price gouged on top of that is just so unjust and unfair. So I bring that up and I think to myself, she also has the president's ear. Maybe I can form this argument in a way that would speak to Trump's ego. And so I said something along the lines of, you know, Trump would go down in history as one of the most popular American presidents if he was able to allow for the negotiation of these pharmaceutical drug prices. And then I said, Democrats claim they want to do it. They claim they want to do it, but they only decided to pass a piece of legislation that allows for the negotiation of like a handful of drug prices. Mm. And those are all drugs that are about to have their patents run out. So they were going to have generic versions come out anyway. So it was like fake change, barely.
Yeah, yeah.
And framing it that way was very appealing to her.
Yeah.
And she's like, oh, well, maybe we can talk to RFK Jr. And, you know, she's like already like the wheels are spinning. She's thinking about how to communicate this to the Trump administration. To me, look, I'm not delusional. Did I think that was going to change anything? I thought there was maybe like a 1% chance. But seeing how she reacted to that argument was really interesting to me. We took a portion of that conversation, played it on the Young Turks, because I was trying to make a point about how we can frame arguments in a way that's appealing to the right. Hmm. People were so mad at me. Oh, my God, I can't believe you're trashing the Democrats and, you know, potentially uplifting Donald Trump. And it's like, okay, we have no power right now. None.
Yeah.
These are the people in power. Mm. So we have two options. We could either sit back and whine incessantly and fearmonger incessantly like we did in his first term and get nothing out of it. Or...
Hi, everybody. This is Joshua Citarella. What you just heard is an excerpt from this week's bonus episode. If you want to hear more and get access to the full catalog for Doomscroll and other podcasts, you can support the show on Patreon or Substack, where I'm putting out new episodes every week. This is an independent show. I don't do any advertising, so your support is really what keeps this project going. Thanks for listening. See you again soon.